9 days before your arrest. So in the first couple of days you went south?
I guess so.
How long have you had the guns?
It was one of the first ones.
From south of the motel?
Yeah, I guess.
I think it was the second.
Yeah, the second.
The guy thought he was real fucking clever hiding the guns behind the books on his shelves. But I always knock the books off the shelves. Right to the floor. People hide all kinds of good shit behind the books. That's how I found the guns.
Bala took out her phone and went to the GPS app. She pulled up a map centered on Santa Monica Boulevard and Wilton Place, where the Siesta Village Motel was located. She started reading off the names of streets to the south. St. Andrews, Western, Ridgewood, Romaine. Nettles kept shaking his head until she came to Sierra Vista.
Wait, he said. Sierra Vista, that sounds familiar.
I think that's it.
What did the house look like? Ballard asked.
I don't know. It looked like a house.
Did it have a garage?
Yeah, a garage in the back, separate.
One floor or two floors?
One. I don't fuck around with two-story jobs.
Okay, was it brick, wood structure, what?
Not brick.
How'd you get in?
I went in the backyard and popped a slider by the pool.
Okay, so there was a pool.
Yeah, next to the garage.
So there was a gate then, like a fence around the pool?
The whole backyard. It was locked and I climbed over.
Was it a wall or a fence?
Fence.
What color was the fence?
It was like gray, stained gray.
How'd you know nobody was home?
I was parked on the street and I saw the guy leave.
In a car?
Yeah.
What kind of car? What color?
It was a Camaro.
Yellow. I remember the car. Cool car.
I wanted that car.
How'd you know the place was empty?
Just because the guy drove off didn't mean the house wasn't full with a wife and kids.
I know. I always knock on the front door. I have a work shirt with my name on the pocket. I act like I'm a gas inspector looking for a leak. If somebody answers, I just go through the motions and go to the next one.
So what did the front door look like? She asked.
It was yellow, Nettles said.
Yeah, yellow. I remember it because it was like the car.
The dude liked yellow.
Ballard and Compton exchanged a look, though they said nothing. They had what they needed for now, a yellow door and a yellow car on Sierra Vista. It wouldn't be hard to find. Chapter 35. There was no yellow door on Sierra Vista. Ballard and Compton drove up and down its four-block stretch four times in the Taurus, but saw no door painted yellow.
You think Nettles intentionally fucked us? Ballard asked.
If he did, he only fucked himself, Compton said. The deal is based on results.
Compton turned and looked out the side window, a sign to Ballard that he was holding something back.
What? She said.
Nothing, he said.
Come on, what's wrong?
I don't know. Maybe you should have stuck with the plan and let me handle the questions.
You were taking too long and I got him describing the house. Don't pout.
I'm not pouting, Renee.
But here we are, Sierra Vista. Where's the yellow door?
He gestured through the windshield. Ballard ignored the complaint. It was unfounded. If he hadn't believed Nettles, he would have said something in the interview room. He didn't, and now he was blaming Ballard for the seeming failure of the move.
She came to a point where Sierra Vista dead-ended into a T, and she pulled over. She looked at the map on her phone screen to see if the street continued elsewhere. She found nothing and used her thumb and finger to expand the map. She checked other streets in the neighborhood to see if there was another Sierra. There wasn't. But there was a Serrano place two blocks south. She put the phone down and pulled the car away from the curb.
Where are we going? Compton asked.
I want to check out another street over here, Ballard said.
Serrano, Sierra, maybe Nettles got it wrong.
They don't even sound close.
Yes, they do. You're just pouting.
Serrano place was only one block long. They covered it quickly. Ballard checking the houses on the left and Compton the right.
Wait a minute, Compton said.
Ballard stopped. She looked out his window at a house with a French door with a yellow frame. The house had tongue and groove wood siding, no bricks. She inched the car forward past the driveway and saw that there was a single car garage detached from the house at the back of the property. A wooden fence grayed by exposure to the elements enclosed the backyard.
The fence is weathered, not stained, she said.
Think there's a pool back there?
If I wasn't pouting, I'd say yes, Compton said.
She punched him in the shoulder and kept driving. Two houses down the street, she pulled to the curb.
Take off your belt, Ballard said.
What? Compton said.
Take off your belt. It will look like a leash. I'm going to see if there's a pool. If I had my van, I'd have a real leash, but your belt will have to do.
Compton got it. He slipped off his belt and handed it to her.
Be right back, she said.
Be careful, he said. Fire a shot if you need me. She got out and walked down the sidewalk back to the house with the yellow French door. She dangled the belt from one hand and called the name Lola out repeatedly. She walked up the driveway that ran next to the house.
Lola, here, girl.
She smelled the pool before she saw it. The sharp odor of chlorine pervaded the rear of the house. She got to the weathered fence and had to stand on her toes to catch a glimpse of what was on the other side. She confirmed the pool and was making a turn to go back out to the street when her eyes caught on the row of windows that ran along the top of the garage door. She hesitated because she wasn't tall enough to look through the glass. Then she saw the handle on the door, situated about a foot off the driveway surface. Ballard stepped over. She put one foot on the handle and tested some of her weight against it. It felt sturdy enough. She put her full weight on the handle and her fingers gripped the thin sill below the windows. She pushed herself up the garage door and looked in. Parked in the garage was a yellow Camaro. She dropped to her heels and turned to get back to her car. A man was standing in the driveway looking at her.
Oh, hey! Have you seen my dog? Ballard said quickly. A brindle boxer mix?
You mean in my garage? The man said.
Sorry about that, but when she gets loose, she likes to hide. It's a real pain in the butt.
He was Latino and wearing workout pants, running shoes, and a hoodie, like he was heading out for a jog. She kept her arm in motion so the dangling belt would not be still enough for him to see that it wasn't a leash. She headed past him toward the street, hoping not to forget the plate number she had read off the Camaro.
Do you live around here? The man asked.
Over on Sierra Vista, Ballard said.
Have a nice day.
She kept moving down the driveway. When she got to the street, she called her dog's name out a few more times, but walked on. She got to the Taurus and jumped back in.
Fuck, 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 I blew it, she said.
She wanted to run the Camaro's plate before she forgot the number, but she realized she didn't have a Rover, and of course the rental car had no police radio.
What happened? Compton asked.
She was watching her side mirror, expecting to see the man step out of the driveway to track her.
A guy came out, she said. I think he made me.
How? Compton asked.
I don't know, something about his eyes. He made me.
Then let's blow. There was no sign of the man in the mirror. She started the car. Just then she saw the Camaro come out of the driveway and turn the opposite way down Serrano.
There he goes, she said. Yellow Camaro.
She waited until the Camaro turned right at the end of the block and was out of sight. She U-turned away from the curb and headed in the same direction. She pulled her phone and called the communications center on speed dial. She then recited the license plate and requested a computer run.
I'll hold, she said.
At the corner, she turned right. There was no sign of the Camaro. She gunned the Taurus and they headed north, block by block, checking right and left for the Camaro. They didn't see it.
You think he spooked him? Compton asked.
I don't know, Ballard said. He saw me looking through the window of the garage at the car.
Shit.
Well, what would you have? The dispatcher came back with the information, and Ballard repeated it so Compton could get it. Eugenio Santana Perez, 71475, no record. Thank you. She disconnected.
The guy's clean, Compton said.
Maybe we're barking up the wrong tree.
Yellow door, yellow Camaro, it's him, Ballard said. He matches Nettle's story. Maybe the guy just bought the gun off somebody, but it's not the wrong tree.
They made their way up to Santa Monica, and there was still no sign of the Camaro.
Right or left, Ballard said.
Fuck it, Compton said. He blew right out of there after seeing you. Now I have to call Wellborn and tell him we may have fucked this up.
Not yet.
What are we going to do?
Just chill. I'm not finished looking. Besides, there's still the house. You can ATFE that.
She saw an opening in the traffic and went straight, crossing Santa Monica and staying north. They continued to check streets until they got to Sunset. Then she took a right toward the 101 freeway.
I'll take you back downtown, Ballard said, defeat in her voice.
This is fucked up, Compton said. But as they approached the southbound freeway ramp, Ballard saw a glimpse of yellow two blocks ahead. A yellow car had turned into a lot and disappeared.
Wait, did you see that? She said.
It was yellow.
I didn't see shit, Compton said. Where?
Ballard drove past the freeway ramp and kept east on Sunset. When she got to the turn-in the yellow car had taken, she saw it was a Home Depot with a massive parking lot. The entrance was clear, and she remembered how it always used to be lined with men looking for day work. That had changed when immigration and customs enforcement started routine immigration roundups. Ballard pulled in and started cruising the lot. They came upon the yellow Camaro in a spot in the far corner. There were plenty of spaces closer to the entrance to Home Depot, so it appeared abandoned there. Ballard checked the plate. It was the car they were looking for. "Shit," she said. "He's gone," Compton said. "Fuck. Another guy who watched Heat too many times." "What? The movie Heat? From the 90s? In spite of the North Hollywood bank shootout? I was on a surfboard in Hawaii most of the 90s. This guy, played by De Niro, was a robber. He had one rule. First sign of heat, you have to be able to leave everything behind. Just like that." Ballard kept cruising, looking at the faces of men on foot in the parking lot, hoping to see the man from the driveway. She had no luck. Finally, she turned the car into the corner of the lot and came to a stop. Through the windshield, they could see the Camaro 50 yards away. "This is so fucked," Compton said. "We should have just called Wellborn. Instead, I listened to you about doing it ourselves." "Are you fucking kidding me?" Ballard said. "You're blaming me? You wanted this just as much as I did. You're the one who always has to win, to show the guys up." "Holy shit, I can't believe you. If you're so worried about the feds, why don't you just Uber your ass out of here? I'll call Wellborn and give him what we've got and put it all on me. I mean, why not, right? Everybody else wants to blame me for everything. Just get the fuck out of the car." Compton looked at her. "You're serious?" he asked. "Deadly," Ballard said. "Get the fuck out." With his eyes still on her, Compton opened his door like he was threatening to leave if she didn't stop him. She didn't. Compton got out and looked back in at her. She said nothing and kept her gaze on the Camaro. He slammed the door. She refused to turn to watch him walk away. "And another one bites the dust," she said to herself. Chapter 36. Ballard didn't get to Hollywood Division until almost 5 o'clock. She had spent most of the afternoon dealing with ATFE and FBI agents, explaining her moves that morning after the interview with Nettles. She left Compton out of it, telling the agents she had acted on her own after leaving Men's Central. The upset of the feds was mollified to a small degree when she looked at a set of photos they had and identified the man she had seen in the driveway. They said Eugenio Santana Perez was an alias, but refused to tell her what his real name was. It was clearly a we'll-take-it-from-here situation, with a heavy tone of, "You fuck this up and now we have to unfuck it to top it off." The feds impounded the Camaro and were waiting on the warrant to enter the house on Serrano Place when Ballard was dismissed with a sarcastic thank you from Agent Wellborn. Back at the station, she pulled a gray inner office envelope out of her mailbox and went to the lieutenant's office to get her new desk assignment. McAdams was standing at his desk, taking his gun out of the drawer and clipping it to his belt, a sign he was heading home. Things were winding down across the entire bureau. "Ballard, you decided to show up," he said. "Sorry, I got tied up downtown, and while I was there I went to check on my victim from the Trent case," she said. "Is there a specific desk you want me to take?" McAdams pointed out the window of his office to the desk on the other side of the glass. It was the worst desk in the house because it was right outside his office, and the computer was positioned so that the lieutenant could see its screen at any time. It was known in the squad as the sitting duck desk. "I was going to put you there, but now it looks like I don't even have to find somebody for the late show," he said. "What do you mean?" Ballard asked. "Well, you must have talked a good game of it down there today, because the LA Times be damned. I just got the word that FID is calling the Trent killing within policy. And not only that, you got your RTD too. Congratulations." Ballard felt a great weight lift off her shoulders. "I hadn't heard," she said. "That seems quick. Whoever your defense rep was, he's going to be in high demand, I'll tell you that," McAdams said. "The picture the Times drew up this morning wasn't pretty." "I didn't use one." "Then that makes this one even more worth celebrating. But if there's a K party, I don't want to know about it." McAdams seemed to be giving a tacit nod of approval to a kill party. It had once been a secret tradition for officers to gather and drink after one of them had killed someone. It was a way of releasing the tension of a life-and-death encounter. Once the department formed the FID to seriously investigate all officer-involved killings, the parties were pushed back until after the FID recommendation was released. Either way, the K party was anachronistic. And if they occurred at all now, it was only under deep secrecy. The last thing Ballard was interested in doing was celebrating her killing of Thomas Trent. "Don't worry, no K party," she said. "Good," McAdams said. Anyway, I'm out of here. Since you've been at it all day, I'll leave Jenkins solo tonight, and you go back on shift starting tomorrow. All good?
Yeah, all good. Thanks, LT.
Ballard looked around and saw an empty desk with a reasonably new computer monitor on it. It was far away from the lieutenant's office and the sitting duck desk, but when she got there, she noticed a mug of coffee and paperwork spread across the workspace. She then did a pivot and spotted another desk nearby, in the burglary row, that looked empty and unused and had a decent monitor. She sat down and the first thing she did was go online to see if the Times had anything on the FID investigation that corrected the morning's story. There wasn't anything yet. She pulled out one of the business cards she had gotten from Towson and started writing him an email, detailing what she had heard from her lieutenant and reporting that there was no action on it so far from the Times. Her cell phone buzzed just as she hit the send button. It was Roger's car of major crimes.
Hey, did you get my message?
I got it, thanks.
So how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. My LT just told me I'm off the pine because FID is calling it within policy.
Of course it was within policy. Are you kidding me? It was totally justified.
Well, you never know. This may come as a surprise to you, but I've pissed some people off in the department.
You?
I find that hard to believe. That was enough sarcastic banter for Ballard. So I heard you checked out my lead with the lawyer, she said.
Towson.
Who told you that? Carr asked.
I have sources.
You were talking to the lawyer, weren't you?
Maybe.
So what's the story?
Carr didn't say anything.
Holy shit, Ballard said. You take my lead and run with it, and now you won't even tell me what you got from it?
I think we're having our last conversation, Detective Carr.
It's not that, Carr said. It's just that I don't think you're going to like what I tell you.
Then it was Ballard who was silent, but not for too long.
Tell me, she said.
Well, yeah, your lead has panned out, Carr said.
Towson said Fabian told him he could deliver a bent cop. Then we got the ballistics back today, and that sort of pivoted things around here.
Pivoted? Why is that?
They didn't match. The weapon used to kill Ken Chastain was not the same one used in the booth at the dancers. The theory at the moment is two different shooters.
They're saying the cases aren't connected.
No, they aren't saying that. Just two weapons, two different shooters. Ballard knew she didn't have the full picture. If the two cases weren't linked by a weapon, then there was something else.
So what am I missing? She asked.
Well, that wasn't the full ballistics report, Carr said.
Carr, come on, stop dicking around.
They identified the weapons off the slugs and brass. The gun in the booth was a 92F, and in the garage it was a Ruger 380. Ballard knew the bullet casings collected at the crime scenes, and the slugs from the bodies revealed markings identifiable to specific models of firearms. Firing pins and gun barrel rifling left proprietary indentations and striations. She also knew the significance of the weapons identified. The 92F was a 9mm Beretta, and it was on the list of firearms approved by the department for carry by detectives. The Ruger was a small popper that was easily concealed and used for close-in work. It, too, was on the department's approved list for backup weapons. It was also a hitter's gun. Ballard was silent while she considered the information. The one piece she reluctantly added to it was her knowledge that Chastain carried a Beretta 92F, or at least he had when they were partners. It drew a question she hated to ask. Chastain carried a 92F. Did they run his gun against the slugs from the dancers? They would have if they had his gun.
That was new information.
You're saying whoever shot him then reached inside his jacket and took his gun?
Apparently.
His weapon has not been recovered.
So what are they thinking?
I was redirected today. I was told to take a deep dive into Chastain, dig up everything.
That is bullshit.
He's not the dancer's shooter.
How do you know that?
I just do. I knew him, and this isn't him.
Well, tell that to Lieutenant Olivas.
What exactly is he saying?
He's not saying anything, at least to me. But one of those guys that got killed in the booth was mobbed up.
Yeah, Gino Santangelo out of Vegas.
Well, you can take it from there.
Ballard thought for a moment.
Take it where, she said.
I totally don't get this.
You're the one who first said it was a cop. You were just looking at the wrong cop.
So Chastain is the booth shooter. He kills a mob guy and then the mob hits him back? That's the working theory? Well, I don't buy it. Why would Kenny do it? That's why we're doing the deep dive. And actually, that's why I called you. Forget it. I'm not going to help you pin this on Chastain. Listen to me. We're not going to pin this on anyone. If it's not there, it's not there, but we have to look. What do you want from me? 4 years ago, you two were partners. Yes. He was in financial trouble then. Did he talk to you about it? The news was surprising to Ballard. He never said a word. What kind of trouble and how do you know? Deep dive, remember? I pulled his credit history. He missed 9 payments on the house and was in foreclosure. He was going to lose the house, and then all of a sudden, it all went away. The bank was paid off and he got solvent. Like, overnight. Any idea how? I told you, I didn't even know about the problem. He never told me. Have you talked to Shelby? Maybe someone in the family helped him out. Not yet. We want to know more before we go to her. That's not going to be pretty. Ballard was silent. She couldn't remember a time when Chastain seemed to be under any sort of pressure from outside the job, financially or otherwise. He was always steady going. She thought of something Carr hadn't covered. What about Metro? She asked. Metro, Carr said. What do you mean? The kid, the witness? Matthew Robeson. Oh, him. He calls himself Metro? We still haven't found him, and frankly, we're not expecting to. But how does he fit into the theory? Well, we know he called Chastain on Friday about 5, and Chastain went to find him. We think he thought Robeson was a threat. So he takes out Robeson, hides or buries the body somewhere, and then goes home. Only there's a mob hitman waiting there, and he pops Chastain in the head before he can even get out of the car. And takes his gun. Right, and takes his gun. They were both silent for a long time after that, until Ballard addressed the elephant in the room. Olivas is still steering all of this? He's in charge. But don't go down that road, Renee. The ballistics are the ballistics. That's not something you can steer, and the financials are what they are as well. But why take the gun? The shooter in the garage? Why did he take the thing that would prove or disprove all of this? Without having that gun for comparison, this is all circumstantial. It's theory. There could be 100 reasons why the gun was taken. And speaking of circumstantial, there is one other thing. What? We checked with internal affairs on Chastain, and there wasn't an open file on him. But they had a string file, where they put the anonymous stuff that comes in. It runs from complaints about some cop was rude to me to some cop keeps coming into my store and taking orange juice without paying. Ticky-tacky stuff like that. Okay. Well, like I said, they had no open file on Chastain, but there were 2 anonymous reports in the string file about an unnamed cop getting into card games and then not being able to cover his losses. What card games? Didn't say. But you know, if a guy wants to get into a high-stakes game in this town, then he can find a game, if you move in that world. Ballard shook her head, even though she knew Carr could not see this. She looked around to make sure her conversation wasn't being heard. The squad room was almost empty now, as most detectives began to shut things down by 4 every day. Still, she leaned into the shelter of her cubicle and spoke quietly to Carr. I'm still not buying it, she said. You guys have nothing but a missing gun, and like you said, there could be 100 reasons why it's gone. It's like you're more interested in pinning this on Chastain than in finding out who killed him. There you go with that word again, Carr said. We aren't pinning anything on anybody, and you know what? I really don't understand you, Renee. Everybody knows that 2 years ago, Chastain hung you out to dry, and you lost the upward trajectory of your career and ended up working the late show. And here you are defending him in a situation where there is clearly a lot of smoke. I mean, a lot of smoke. Well, that's the thing, right? A lot of smoke? Back when I worked downtown, before I supposedly lost my upward trajectory, we needed more than smoke. We needed a lot more. If there is fire, we're going to find it. Good luck with that, Carr. I'll talk to you later. Ballard disconnected and sat frozen at the desk. She had started the theory that the dancer shooter was a cop. Now that theory was a monster and had Chastain in its sights. She wondered how long it would be before Carr found out that the backup gun on her ankle was a Ruger 380. Chapter 37. Ballard calmed herself. The Ruger on her ankle was on the department's short list of approved backups. She and probably 1,000 other cops owned one. She then started overthinking it, wondering if Carr already knew she had one, and the purpose of the phone call was to see if she'd bring it up voluntarily. Her keeping quiet may have landed her on the suspect list. They are really thinking a cop did the dancers thing? Ballard swiveled in her chair and saw a detective named Rick Tigert sitting at the desk directly behind hers. She had not realized that he could have overheard her half of the conversation with Carr. "Look, don't repeat that anywhere, Rick," she said quickly. "I thought you had left." "I won't. But if it's true, the department's going to be dragged through the shit once again," Tigert said. "Yeah, well, some things can't be helped. Look, I don't know if it's true. Just keep it to yourself." "Yeah, no problem." Ballard turned back to her temporary desk and started opening the inner office envelope that she had found in her mail slot. The previous recipient had his name crossed out on the address line, just above Ballard's name. It said Feltzer, F-I-D. The envelope contained copies of the search warrant return executed at Thomas Trent's house the day before. Feltzer had made good on his coerced promise to share. The return was the document submitted to the court that had authorized the warrant. The law required law enforcement to report back to the judge, so that there was an outside authority standing vigilant against unlawful search and seizure. The returns were usually very detailed about every item taken during a search. Feltzer had also supplemented this with a stack of crime scene photos of each item seized in the place where it was found. Ballard tried to put the Chastain matter out of her mind for the time being, by jumping back into the Trent case. She studied the list of items taken from the house on Wrightwood. Most were common items that served a purpose in a household or workshop, but could take on sinister qualities when in possession of a suspected serial sex offender. Things like duct tape, zip ties, pliers, a ski mask. The zinger was the collection of brass knuckles from a drawer in the bedside table in the master bedroom. There was no further description of them, so Ballard immediately flipped to the photos and found the shot of four pairs of brass knuckles in the drawer. Each set was of unique design and materials, but all carried the same words on the impact plates: good and evil. Ballard assumed that one of the sets was the weapon that Ramona Ramon had been tortured with. While she didn't need the brass knuckles to solidify the case against Trent, especially since no case would be moving forward, there was still a silent moment of clarity, fulfillment, and knowledge that she had followed the correct trail in her investigation. Her only regret was that she had no one to share the moment with. Jenkins wasn't coming in for another 6 hours, and he had never been invested in the case anyway. Only Ballard had been committed to it. She noticed that Feltzer had included copies of all the crime scene photographs, so she slowly leafed through the stack of 8x10s. It was a photo tour of the house, and Ballard was reminded that she had never seen the entire place. She was struck by the normalcy of it. Spare and out-of-date furnishings were in every room. The only piece that allowed her to date the photos as reasonably contemporary was the flat-screen television on the living room wall. The last photos in the stack were of the lowest room in the upside-down house, and these included shots of Trent in situ, as he had been found. There was more blood on him and the floor than Ballard had remembered. His eyes were half-lidded. She spent a long time studying the photos of the man she had killed. She only pulled her eyes away when her cell phone started to buzz. She looked at the screen. It was Towson. "Have you checked the website?" he said. "It's up. It's good." "Hold on," she said. She pulled up the Times website on her screen. The story wasn't the main selection on the homepage, but it was the third story listed. She opened it, noted that it had Jerry Castor's byline, and quickly read it. She was pleased with what she saw, especially the money paragraph. Sources within the department said early reports that questioned Ballard's actions did not include the entire raft of evidence and circumstances reviewed. It is expected that the department's Force Investigation Division will make a determination that Ballard acted bravely and used justifiable force when she stabbed Trent with a splintered piece of wood in an effort to save her life and that of another victim abducted by the suspect. The FID's findings will go to the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, which will make a final determination on the detective's actions. "Yeah, it's good," Ballard said. "What do you think?" "I think we made a mistake," he said. "We should have told Feltzer you wanted a promotion to captain, too. He gave us everything we wanted. In fact, I checked on your van, and they said you can pick it up tomorrow. They're finished with it." She hadn't known he was going to do that. His taking that initiative suggested to Ballard that things were maybe going to get awkward with Towson. "Thank you very much, Dean," she said. "For all of it. You really turned this around. Wasn't me, he said. You made this about the easiest case I've ever handled.
Well, good. And by the way, I gave your card to Trent's victim, the one who brought me into the case. I told her she should go after the equity in that house and to call you.
Well, I'm much obliged.
And you know, Renee, this is now a closed matter as far as my involvement. That means it would not be a conflict if we were to stay in touch. You know, socially.
There it was. The awkward overture.
It was routine to get hit on by men in the department, as well as the larger field of the justice system. That was how she and Compton had hooked up. A shared experience leading to something more. She'd been feeling Towson's interest growing since the interview at his townhouse Sunday morning. The problem was she did not return his interest, especially after the ordeal she had just been through.
I think I want to keep this on a professional level, Dean, she said. I may need your legal services in the future, and I liked how you handled this. A lot.
She hoped that puffing him up on a professional level would allow the personal rejection to go down easier.
Well, of course, he said. Whatever you need, Renee, I'm here for you.
But think about it. We could always have both.
Thank you, Dean, she said.
After ending the call, Ballard went back to the photos, studying once again the shots of Trent's body and the room on the bottom floor of the upside-down house. Seeing the body in blood allowed her to go back to it and go over it in her mind's eye. She relived the steps she took, the escape from her bindings, and then the attack. She cupped her right hand around her left wrist. It was the one she had first freed, and it had suffered the deepest laceration from the zip tie. The photos made her feel the pain again, but it was earned. It was sacrifice. She could not articulate it even to herself, but by going through it again in her head and not second-guessing anything was therapeutic. It was needed. She almost didn't hear her name being called from the other side of the squad room. She looked up and saw Denitra Lewis waving a clipboard at her from just outside McAdam's office. Lewis was the division's records and property clerk. Ballard knew that at the end of each day, Lewis dropped off evidence logs in the lieutenant's inbox so that he would be apprised of the comings and goings on different cases. Ballard got up and went over to see what she wanted.
What's up, Denitra?
What's up is I need a disposition on the property you got in my locker. You can't just leave it there forever.
What do you mean?
I'm saying you've got that bag sitting in one of my boxes since last week.
The one going to Chastain at RHD?
He was supposed to take it Friday.
Well, like I'm saying, it's still in that locker, and it's got a hold for you on it, not him. I need you to come get it. I need the space.
Ballard was confused. The evidence bag contained the belongings of Cynthia Haddle, the waitress gunned down in the dancers' massacre. Ballard knew that she was an ancillary victim, but it didn't make a lot of sense to her that Chastain had not taken the property bag early Friday morning when he had been at the station. She had told him about it. But even if Chastain hadn't taken the bag, because his hands were full with the witness Xander Spates, it should have been transported by courier Monday morning to property division downtown and held for him there. That was the procedure. But Lewis was saying that none of that had happened, that the bag was on hold for her.
I don't know what's going on with that, but I'll go check it in a few minutes, Ballard said.
Lewis thanked her and left the squad room. Ballard went back to the desk she was using, stacked the photos and the search warrant returned together, and put them back into the inner office mailer so that they would not be lying around on display. She then locked the envelope in her file cabinet and headed back to the property room. Lewis was gone and the room was empty. Ballard opened the locker in which she had put the brown paper bag that contained Cynthia Haddle's personal effects. She took the bag out and carried it over to the counter. The first thing she noticed was that the bag was double-taped. A second layer of red evidence tape had been applied over the first, meaning the bag had been opened and resealed since Ballard had placed it in the locker early Friday morning. She assumed that Chastain had done this. She next checked the property transfer label and saw that this too was new. Handwritten instructions on the label said to hold the property for Detective Ballard at Hollywood Division. Ballard recognized the handwriting as Chastain's. Ballard grabbed a box cutter off the counter, cut through the tape and opened the bag. From it, she pulled the plastic evidence bag she had placed inside the paper bag the morning after Haddle's murder. She noticed that one of these was also double-taped. It had been opened and resealed. Without breaking the new seal on the bag, she spread it out on the counter so she could see its contents through the plastic. There was an inventory list inside, and she was able to check everything against it, from Haddle's phone to her tip apron
to the cigarette box containing the vial of Molly. Based on what Roger's car had said about Chastain now being the focus of the investigation, Ballard wondered what Chastain had been up to. Was there something in the bag that he wanted to keep hidden from RHD? Was it something on Hattell's phone? Or had he taken something? There was no easy answer. Ballard grabbed the top corners of the bag and flipped it over on the counter so that she could examine its contents from the other side. Right away she noticed a business card that hadn't been there before, slipped down into the cellophane wrap of the cigarette box. It was Chastain's LAPD business card. Ballard went over to the latex glove dispenser on the wall and grabbed a pair. She snapped the gloves on and went back to the evidence bag. She cut the seal and reached in for the cigarettes. She removed the box and examined it closely before slipping the business card out. There was a name written on the side of the card, not visible when it had been behind the cigarette box cellophane. Eric Higgs, VMD. Ballard didn't recognize the name or know the meaning of the initials, VMD. She put the card aside and opened the cigarette box. The vial was still there, and it appeared to be half full, as it was when Ballard had discovered it. She decided to look through everything to see if anything else stood out to her as having been tampered with. The phone was now useless. It had long since used up its charge. She opened the tip apron next and saw what appeared to be the same contents as before. A fold of currency, more cigarettes, a lighter, and a small notebook. She took out the money and counted it. Not a dollar was missing, and there was no clue as to what Chastain had been up to. Ballard pulled out her phone. She took off a glove, typed in Eric Higgs, and fired the name into her search engine. She got a variety of responses. There was an artist, a college football player, a chemistry professor at the University of California, Irvine, and several others. But none of the people with the name connected to Ballard on any level of significance. Next, she typed VMD into the search engine and got numerous results, including references to visual molecular dynamics, veterinary medicine's directorate, and vector Mason dominance. Far down the list, she saw the words vacuum metal deposition, and the explanatory line beneath it grabbed her attention with one word. The physical process of coating evidence with very thin metal film. Ballard remembered reading something about this process. She clicked on the link to an article and started reading. VMD was a forensic technique in which applications of gold and zinc to evidence in low-pressure environment revealed latent fingerprints on objects and materials usually deemed too porous to produce prints. The process had been successful in applications on plastics, pattern metals, and some woven fabrics. The article was 2 years old and from a website called Forensic Times. It said the technique was complicated and required a sizable pressure chamber and other equipment, not to mention the expensive metals, gold, and zinc. Therefore, its study and application were primarily carried out on the university level and in private forensic labs. At the time of the article, it said neither the FBI nor any major metropolitan police department in the United States had a VMD chamber, and that this was hindering law enforcement use of the technique in criminal cases. The article listed a handful of private labs and universities where the application of VMD was either offered or being studied. Among these was UC Irvine, where Ballard had just determined that Eric Higgs was a chemistry professor. Ballard quickly repackaged all of Cynthia Hattell's property back into the brown paper bag and resealed it with tape from a dispenser on the counter. She then carried the bag back to the detective bureau, where she went to work tracking down Professor Higgs. 20 minutes later, and thanks to the university police department, she placed a call to a lab assigned to the professor. Ballard judged the voice that answered as being too young to be a professor. "I'm looking for Professor Higgs." "He's gone."
"For the day?"
"Yeah, for the day."
"Who is this?"
"Well, who is this?" "Detective Renee Ballard, Los Angeles Police Department. It's very important that I reach Professor Higgs. Can you help me?"
"Well, I..."
"Who is this?"
Steve Stillwell. I'm the grad assistant in the lab."
"Is this the VMD lab?"
"Well, it's not exactly a VMD lab, but we have the setup here, yeah."
Ballard grew more excited with the confirmation.
"Do you have a cell phone for Professor Higgs, or any way I could reach him?"
"I have a cell. I guess I could... I'm not sure it's allowed."
"Mr. Stillwell, I'm calling about a murder investigation. Do you understand? Either give me that number or call Professor Higgs yourself and ask permission to give it to me. I need you to do it one way or another right now." Okay, let me get the number. I have to look it up on this phone, so I won't hear you if you say anything.
Just hurry, Mr. Stillwell.
Ballard couldn't contain herself while waiting. She got up and started pacing one of the aisles in the detective bureau, while Stillwell got the number out of his phone. Finally, he started to call it out as he read it off his phone screen. Ballard raced back to her workstation and wrote the number down. She disconnected the call with Stillwell just as he brought the phone back to his mouth and said, "Got it?" She dialed the number and the man answered after only one ring.
"Professor Higgs?"
"Yes?"
"My name is Ballard. I'm a detective with the Los Angeles Police Department."
There was a long moment before he responded.
"You worked with Ken Chastain, didn't you?"
Ballard felt a bolt of energy go through her chest.
"Yes, I did. I thought you might call. He told me that if anything happened to him, I could trust you."
Chapter 38. It was a brutal drive in heavy traffic down to Irvine in Orange County. Professor Higgs had agreed to come back to the school and meet Ballard at his lab. Along the way, she thought about the lead she was chasing. Ken Chastain had very clearly left it for her to find. He knew he was on dangerous ground, and he had a backup plan that would kick in if something happened to him. Ballard was that plan. By redirecting the Hattle property back to her, Chastain guaranteed that she would get it after the weekend and would find the clue leading to Professor Higgs. When she finally got to UC Irvine, she had to call Higgs twice on his cell phone to get directions to the Natural Sciences building, where he was on the fourth floor. The building seemed empty as Ballard entered, and she found Higgs alone in his lab. He was tall and gangly, and younger than Ballard had expected. He greeted her warmly and seemed relieved of some weight or concern.
"I didn't know," he said. "I'm so damn busy I don't have time to read a newspaper or watch TV. I didn't know what happened until yesterday, when I called the number he gave me and his wife told me. It's an awful thing, and I hope to God this had nothing to do with it."
He gestured toward the back of the lab, where there was a steel pressure tank about the size of a washer and dryer stack.
"I'm here to try to find that out," Ballard said.
"You spoke to his wife?"
"Yes, she answered the phone," Higgs said. "She told me what had happened, and I was completely stunned."
It meant that Chastain had given Higgs his home number, not his office line or his cell number. This was significant to Ballard because it was another indication, along with his actions at the crime scene and his handling of the Hattle evidence, that Chastain was trying to keep at least some of his moves on the dancer's case below the surface and untraceable through normal measures.
"Is there a place we could sit down and talk?" Ballard asked.
"Sure, I've got an office," Higgs said.
"Follow me."
Higgs led the way through a series of interconnecting labs within the general lab into a small and cluttered office, big enough for a desk and a single visitor's chair. They sat down and Ballard asked him to tell the story of his interaction with Chastain from the start.
"You mean go back to the first case?" he asked.
"I guess so," Ballard said.
"What was the first case?"
"Well, the first time I ever spoke to Detective Chastain was when he called me up about 2 years ago. He said he had read about VMD in the Journal of Forensic Sciences or some other journal, I can't remember which one, and he wanted to know if the process could erase fingerprints on a basketball." Higgs' story was already ringing true for Ballard. She knew from her years as Chastain's partner that he prided himself on staying up on advances in techniques in forensics, interrogation, and legal protocol. Some of the other detectives even nicknamed him the Scholar because of his extracurricular reading. It would not have been unusual for Chastain to pick up the phone and call a scientist directly when he had a question about evidence.
"Did he say what the case was?" Ballard asked.
"Yeah, it was a shooting on a playground," Higgs said. "A kid got into an argument during a one-on-one game, and the other kid grabbed a gun out of his backpack at the side of the court and shot him. So Detective Chastain thought the shooter had to have left prints on the ball because he had been playing with it, you know? But the police lab said they couldn't do it because the ball was rubber and had a dimpled and porous surface. He asked me to give it a try."
"And what happened?"
"I like a challenge. I told him to bring it down here, and we tried, but we couldn't pull anything up that was usable. I mean, we got some ridges here and there, but nothing that he could take back and put through the latent print archives."
"So then what?"
"Well, that was sort of it. Until he called me last week and asked if he could send me something he wanted to try to get a print off of."
"What was it?"
"He called it a thumb button."
"When exactly was this call?"
"Early Friday. I was in the car heading here and he called my cell. I can check my phone log if you want the exact time."
"If you don't mind."
"Sure."
Higgs pulled the phone out of his pocket and went into the call list. He scrolled through the listing of calls going back to early Friday morning. "This is it," he said. "Came in at 7:41 a.m., Friday." "Can I see the number?" Ballard asked. Higgs held the phone out across the desk, and Ballard leaned forward to read the screen. The number was 213-972-2971, and Ballard knew it wasn't Chastain's cell. It was the general number at Hollywood Station. Chastain had used a landline in the property room to call Higgs, at the same time he was going through the evidence bag containing Cynthia Haddell's property. "What exactly did he ask you when he called?" Ballard asked. "He said he was dealing with emergency circumstances on a big case," Higgs said. "And he wanted to know if I could VMD something as small as a dime and get a print off it."
"And what did you tell him?"
"Well, I first asked what material we were talking about, and he said it was a metal button that had an uneven surface because of an imprint. I told him all I could do was try. I told him that once I actually got a print off a dime, right off of Roosevelt's jaw. So he said he would send it down and that I should only talk to him about it." It was clear to Ballard that by 7:41 a.m. Friday morning, less than 8 hours after the massacre at the Dancers, Chastain already knew, or was at least suspicious, that there was police involvement. He took measures to hide his suspicions and protect himself, using the station's phone instead of his own to call Higgs, and leaving behind the evidence bag containing his business card, with Higgs' name written on the back. "So he mailed it to you or delivered it?" she asked.
"Mailed it.
It came Saturday by certified mail," Higgs said. "Do you by any chance still have that packaging?" Ballard was thinking in terms of being able to document the chain of custody of the evidence. It could become important if there was a trial. Higgs thought for a moment, then shook his head.
"No, it's trashed. The cleaners come through here on Saturday night."
"And where's the button?"
"Let me go get it. I'll be right back."
Higgs got up and left the office. Ballard waited. She heard a drawer in the lab open and close, and then the professor came back. He handed her a small plastic evidence bag containing what looked like a small black cap that was threaded on the inside of its edges. Ballard was sure it was the bag and object that she had glimpsed Chastain with at the crime scene early Friday morning. Chastain had obviously recognized what it was and knew its significance. She turned the bag to study the object. It was actually slightly smaller than a dime, with a flat head and a word stamped across it. Lawmaster. It was a word familiar to Ballard, but she couldn't immediately place it. She pulled her phone so she could plug the word into a search engine.
"It came with a note," Higgs said. "In the package, it said, 'If something happens, trust Renee Ballard.' So when you called..."
"Do you still have that note?" Ballard asked.
I believe I do, somewhere around here. I'll have to find it, but I know I didn't toss it. If you could, I'd like to see it."
Ballard pressed the search button and got two hits on the word. Lawmaster was the name of a motorcycle used by Judge Dredd in a series of comic books and movies. It was also a company that made leather equipment belts and holsters geared toward the law enforcement community. Ballard clicked on the link to the company's website as she remembered the brand. Lawmaster specialized in leather holsters, particularly the kind of shoulder holsters favored by the gunslingers in the department, the testosterone-enhanced hard chargers, who put form over function, and were willing to take the discomfort of having leather straps crisscross their backs over the simple ease and comfort of a far less macho hip holster. Most of these gunslingers were the young up-and-comers, who never missed a chance to check their looks in a mirror or take their jackets off at a crime scene to impress onlookers as well as themselves. Still, there were also some old-school cowboys who preferred the gunslinger look, and Ballard knew Lieutenant Robert Olivas was among them. The website showed a variety of shoulder holsters, and Ballard clicked on one that counterbalanced the gun under one arm with double ammo clips under the other. She enlarged the accompanying photo and studied the workmanship of the holster. She saw several adjustment points for giving the holster a custom fit and positioning the weapon at an angle offering easy access to its wearer. These adjustment points were held in place by shallow screws and threaded black caps with a Lawmaster logo stamped on them. It was a cascade moment when all the details of the investigation came together. Ballard now knew what Chastain knew, and understood his moves in surreptitiously taking evidence from the crime scene and attempting to analyze and safeguard it from afar. Ballard held up the plastic bag containing the Lawmaster cap.
"Professor Higgs, were you able to get a print off this?"
"Yes, I was. I got one good solid print." Chapter 39. Ballard stayed in the Miyako again Wednesday night, taking sushi for dinner in her room once more before going to sleep. She had enough clothes in her bag for another day without replacement, and in the morning made the quick drive over to the Piper Technical Center, which was home to the Layton Print Unit, as well as the department's Aero Squadron. Every detective with more than a few years on the job has procured a tech in each of the forensic disciplines who can be counted on for an occasional favor or jump into the waiting line when needed. Some of the disciplines are more important than others because there are more common to crimes. Fingerprints are found at just about every crime scene, and therefore the Layton Print Unit was the most important place to have a connection in the entire forensic sandbox. Ballard's go-to was a supervisor named Polly Stanfield. 5 years earlier, Ballard and Stanfield had worked a difficult case, where fingerprints were the link between three separate sex assault murders. But while the prints from each scene matched, Stanfield could find no match in the various databases that housed print records around the world. Only the relentless efforts of both women finally resulted in an arrest, when Stanfield surreptitiously accessed a database of rental applications for a massive apartment complex in the valley that was geographically central to the murders. Renters at the complex were required to give fingerprints with their applications, but nothing was ever done with them. It was just a way of discouraging applicants who might lie about having criminal records. Once Stanfield's work identified the suspect, Ballard and her then-partner Chastain had to find another way to come up with his name so as not to reveal Stanfield's hack of the apartment complex's rental applications. They resorted to the tried-and-true anonymous call from a burner cell revealing the suspect's identity to a department crime tip line, and no one ever knew the difference. Ballard got Stanfield in the divorce. That is, when she and Chastain split as partners. Most people in the department and ancillary agencies chose a side to stand with. Stanfield, who in a long career in law enforcement, had encountered her share of overly aggressive men and sexual harassment, sided with Ballard. Ballard knew Stanfield worked 7 to 4, and she was there at the door of the LPU with two lattes at 6:55 a.m. An earlier phone call between the two women had covered the basics of what needed to be done, so Stanfield was not surprised by Ballard's appearance or by the high sugar content of her latte. It had been special ordered. "Let's see what you've got," Stanfield said by way of a greeting. As a supervisor, Stanfield had a small cubbyhole office, but it was still better than the open work pod most of the other print techs got. Stanfield was well-versed in how to deal with what Ballard was bringing in. The VMD process resulted in a fingerprint being temporarily identifiable on a surface of the holster cap. It had then been photographed under oblique lighting conditions by Professor Higgs. What Ballard had for Stanfield was a photograph of a thumbprint. Stanfield began her work with a magnifying glass, looking closely at the photo to confirm there was a usable print. "This thumb is really good," she finally said. "Good clear ridges, but it's going to take a while. It's a scan and trace job." That was more than a hint from Stanfield that she would prefer not to have Ballard looking over her shoulder the whole time. She needed to scan the photo into her computer, then go through a tedious process of using a program to trace the lines and swirls of the thumbprint so that a clean print could be run through the automated fingerprint index system. There were more than 70 million prints in the AFIS databank. Sending a print through did not bring instantaneous results, and often the results, when they came, were not singular. The search often kicked out several similar prints, and that required the print tech to make the final comparison under a microscope to determine if there was a match. "You want me to leave and come back?" Ballard asked. "How long?" "Give me at least a couple hours," Stanfield said. "If I get through it quicker, I'll call." Ballard stood up. "Okay, but remember," she said, "keep this under the table. Don't tell anyone what case it is or what you're doing. And if you get a match, tell only me." Stanfield put the magnifying glass down on the lab table and looked at her. "Are you trying to scare me?" she asked. "No, but I want you to be cautious. If you get a name and it's the name I'm thinking it will be, then you'll understand what I'm saying." Ballard didn't want to share her investigative theory with Stanfield prior to the work. She didn't want to infect her conclusions with any preconceived ideas of who the print would match. "Holy shit," Stanfield said. "Well, thanks a lot, Renee. You know, I really liked working here." "Don't be so dramatic," Ballard said. "Just see what you get, and I'll be back." Chapter 40. Ballard used the time to walk over to the print shed that was located behind Piper Tech. Knowing how citizens were often treated when they attempted to pick up their impounded and printed vehicles, she half expected a delay in the paperwork from FID releasing her van. But it was ready to go. She wasn't wrong about her expectations about its condition, however. The first clue was the driver's door handle, which was still dusted with black fingerprint powder. She opened the door and found the driver's compartment bombed with powder as well. She knew from crime scene experience that the black powder could ruin clothes and be impossible to get out with home car washing. She went back to the garage's office and angrily demanded that the van be returned in drivable condition. This resulted in a stare down with the garage manager, but he changed his demeanor when Ballard produced her badge. He dispatched two of his garage greasers with a high-powered vacuum, a roll of paper towels, and a bottle of industrial-strength cleaner into the van. Ballard stood by, watched the work, and pointed out every spot they missed. After an hour, she thought about calling Polly Stanfield, but she knew that would only annoy her. She decided to check in at Hollywood Detectives instead and call Lieutenant McAdams' direct line. "Ballard, what are you doing awake?" he asked. "I have you back on the schedule tonight." "I'll be there, LT, don't worry," she said. "Just checking in. What's happening in the six?" "Only thing I got going is an assist with the feds. They got a takedown team surrounding some fool holed up in the Batcave." That was a reference to a cave up in Bronson Canyon that had been used during the filming of the 1960s Batman television show. "What do they want him for?" "A double bagger in Texas. Killed two armored car guards a couple years ago and lammed it over here." "What are we doing?" "Crowd and traffic control." Ballard knew it was the guy she had spooked with Compton. She wondered if she would escape with no blowback from the feds, if they successfully brought him down at the Batcave. Just then she got a call waiting buzz on her phone. She checked and saw it was Stanfield. "Hey, LT, I have a call coming in. I gotta go." "Okay, Ballard, go." She disconnected and switched over. "Polly, I got a hit on that thumb. It's a cop. What did you get me into, Renee?" Chapter 41. Ballard stepped out of the interrogation room at the Metropolitan Detention Center, crossed the wide hallway, and entered the control center. She looked at the monitor for the interrogation room. Lieutenant Olivas sat in a chair, facing the overhead camera, his arms pulled into a locked position behind his back. He knew she was looking at him and had his head tilted back. He scowled at the camera. Ballard raised her phone and took a photo of the monitor. She then texted the shot to Roger's car with a message. "I need help. He won't talk to me." As she expected, it didn't take long for Carr to respond. "WTF, where are you?" Her reply was terse. She wasn't interested in a text debate. She needed Carr to come to the jail. "MDC, you coming? I want to flip him." There was no response. Minutes dragged by and she knew Carr was debating with himself whether to come over, whether to risk his career and the enmity of the department by getting involved in the attempted takedown of a prize lieutenant. Ballard tried one more time to coax him. "I have the evidence." Another minute went by. It felt like an hour. Then Carr returned. "On my way." Ballard realized she had been holding her breath. She released it in relief, and turning to the two officers monitoring the screens, told them that Carr was on his way. She was still in the control center when Carr was announced, and he entered the hallway 15 minutes later. Ballard stepped out to meet him. His forehead was slick with a film of sweat. That told her that he had covered the three blocks on foot and must have left the PAB without hesitation after their text conversation. He glanced through the square window on the door to interrogation room A and looked at Olivas. He then quickly turned away as though he couldn't take what he saw. He focused on Ballard and spoke in a low, controlled voice. "What the fuck, Ballard? How the hell did you get him in here?" "I lured him out of the PAB. I told him I had someone here who was ready to confess." "And then you fucking arrest him? On what evidence?" He said the last word too loud, almost as a shriek. He brought his hand to his mouth and checked the officers in the control center, then dropped back down to a whisper. "Listen to me. You are moving too fast," he said. "Everything I have? It points to Chastain, not Olivas. Not a fucking RHD lieutenant. Do you know what you're doing here? You are committing career suicide. You need to stop this right now." I can't, Ballard said. I know it wasn't Chastain. He took measures because he knew it was a cop. That's why Olivas killed him.